This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. How much cash do you have on you right now? Chances are it's not that much. Overall, Americans are using less cash, but we're far from being a cashless society. But in 2018, could this be the year when many of us make the jump to some form of smartphone pay almost exclusively? There are a lot of ways to do that. We're going to be talking about what consumers need to know about going cashless. Why is that a trend? How using a digital wallet could be in your future? Also, Bitcoin. What is Bitcoin, this star performer cryptocurrency? Will we be using blockchain to shop for groceries? I think not. But what is blockchain, and why should we all care? We're going to talk about this from a consumer point of view, how this is going to impact our lives, to give an overall view of these things, not to provide investment advice. But we invite you to call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. We're joined by Tom Moreno, Jr. He is Executive Vice President of Technology and Operations at the Bank of San Antonio. Ainsley Harris is with us online. She is a staff writer at Fast Company. Gina Peters is a professor of economics at Trinity University, research associate at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, and a fellow at the University College London Center for Blockchain Technologies. And again, the number to call in, if you've got a question or comment, 210-614-8980. And Ainsley Harris at Fast Company, let me go to you first. Can you kind of give me an overall assessment about where we are in the United States switching to digital wallets and these apps to start paying for things?
Sure. Yeah, I think it really depends right now how old you are for most folks. I think the younger generation has really embraced some of these new forms of payment more quickly and are starting to kind of be the early leaders here in how we're seeing how this is changing how people shop and what they buy. Probably no coincidence that that younger consumers are also more likely to be shopping online versus in store. You know, I think obviously using a digital wallet makes a lot of sense if you're shopping on your phone. You don't really have another choice. So I think we're starting to see this evolution happen. But the U.S., frankly, is still, you know, pretty far behind some other countries. China, for one, has really taken the lead. It's amazing just how quickly, even paying for something as small as just a bottle of water or of newspaper is now, you know, pretty commonplace to have a vendor tell you they don't even accept cash. So, you know, that has happened so quickly in other countries. I think the progression has been slower here, but we are seeing mobile wallets, digital payments start to take root here as well.
So Ainsley Harris, what is the leading method? There's so many competing ways to do this. I think one thing that's holding people back is figuring out, I don't want five different apps to do this. I want to go to one.
Yeah, definitely. Right now, you need to have, in many cases, different apps for transferring money to your friends versus buying something offline with your phone versus buying something online with your phone. It might depend on which retailer you're in. I think we've seen folks that have succeeded with retailers that have succeeded with wallets are those that have added things on top of the wallet that make a lot of sense for their consumer, whether it's sort of coordinating the delivery of goods that you're going to pick up at the store, making sure that something's in stock, or maybe a sort of rewards program. When things like that are baked into a retailer wallet, we've seen adoption really go up for the kind of loyal customer base, maybe like a Walmart or a Target, someone like that can pull that off. For the other stuff, it tends to be, on the sort of paying your friends, it's a bit more social. You know, what does your social group use? And that's where we've seen things like Venmo really take off.
But there's like Apple Pay, Android yeah. Pay, and other efforts, PayPal, of course. Are any one of these a leader in the industry? Or are they all kind of jockeying right now? Are we in that Betamax sort of mode right now, trying to figure out which format is going to be the leader?
Yeah, I think we're seeing some real jockeying. I think you're right. I think Apple has been pretty aggressive in getting lots of big retailers to sign on. Right now, there's just not really a critical reason to use any of these digital wallets when you're shopping offline. And so that has been, you know, the real kind of drag on the adoption here. And so I think, you know, someone like Apple, where it's sort of built into the operating system of your phone, if they can convince you to start going back again and again to Apple Pay is the way that you buy things online when you're shopping on your phone, if they can kind of lock in that behavior, eventually down the road, perhaps they're well positioned to, as things offline go digital, to be what you would use, and that is similarly for Android. So I think, you know, that jockeying is definitely happening. People are kind of preparing themselves for that eventual offline behavior switch, but right now it's, you know, really about, you know, if you're browsing for clothes or something online, you know, on your phone, with Apple Pay, it's pretty simple. Some apps only allow you to pay with Apple Pay, and same on the Android side.
Tom Moreno at the Bank of San Antonio, what does that look like from the banking point of view? And you are there mainly serving businesses, and are businesses coming up with questions like, do I need to be ready for something?
Businesses are always concerned about cash flow and what they can do to increase their payment speed and the safety and security of those payments. And so they're watching all of these different payment methods to see what do they need to do to remain relevant and be competitive in the marketplace. For businesses that have B2B transactions, business to business, they may not be as interested in some of these mobile wallets, but certainly businesses that serve consumers would be interested in that sort of thing.
And their concerns are, you know, they want stuff that is fast, safe, secure, and if something goes wrong, some way to rectify it. Are those the concerns?
Absolutely. And when you look at consumers' behaviors, and of course, I'm certainly a consumer, and so I think of these things, I might leave my home without my wallet accidentally, but very rarely do I leave without my phone. And so when you consider that type of behavior, you would think that these mobile wallets would increase in popularity. But with the amount of effort that it takes to launch the mobile payment from your phone and to process that transaction at a point of sale, I think that most folks agree today, at least, that it's easier to use a card and faster for that transaction to whip it out of your wallet and do that. One of the things that I thought about a while back ago as I sat at a resort and was thinking, how could I use my phone if I'm somewhere where there's water, like by the pool, for example, where it's easy to put your card in your wallet, it's not affected. The new phones that are coming out now have addressed that issue, being water resistant, to where you could actually have your phone and still use it if you want to use a mobile wallet. You know, the interesting thing you were asking a moment ago about Apple Pay is that it represents 90% of the transactions globally from the big three. So that's Apple, Samsung, and Google or Android Pay. And so, but only 25% of those transactions for Apple are processed here in the U.S. And so obviously the rest of the world is adopting that technology faster than the U.S. is.
All right, so we're going to be talking about if moving to a cashless society, a cashless economy, is that better for the overall economy? We've seen that in China and in India, that much of this effort was driven by the government pulling currency from the system, asking people or telling people, this is how you're going to do things. If you're going to get people to go into a cashless society, it certainly helps when you give them a few choices. But are we ready to adopt that here in the United States? Are you ready to do that as a consumer? Are you ready to give up your wad of cash? Give us a call. We want to hear from you. What are your thoughts? What's holding you back? What are you waiting for? The number is 210-614-8980. When we come back, we'll talk more about Bitcoin. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about this new revolution that we're having in the way we deal with money. Money's getting a makeover. Currency, to be current in currency, you got to know about things like Bitcoin. Well, what is Bitcoin? We're joined by Gina Peters. She's a professor of economics at Trinity University, research associate at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, and a fellow at the University College London Center for Blockchain Technologies. And Gina, thanks for being with us today. So Bitcoin, what is that?
So Bitcoin is one of the examples of cryptocurrencies. There's thousands of them at this point. The big three, Bitcoin, Ripple, Ethereum, Bitcoin Cash, that's more than three. But so Bitcoin is about a third of the market right now. And then you've got Ripple and Ethereum coming in. They're all based on what's known as the blockchain technology. So blockchain is essentially a way of storing data. It's a new kind of database. And each blockchain associated with cryptocurrencies are slightly different. I'm again just talking about the Bitcoin blockchain, which was the first one. That's why everyone knows it. It's the original.
It created this type of technology.
Well, it combined several existing technologies to create this blockchain technology.
Okay, and so real basic, blockchain is, well, let me give it a shot at it, okay? Decentralized sort of ledger system that multiple computers all over the world are sort of, that's the reason why a lot of people trust this, is because there is no central bank or central government that's going to control this currency, but it's basically everyone sort of keeping tabs with each other with this calculation stuff.
Exactly. So a big problem is if you're spending money online, you need to somehow verify that you have the money to spend, right? If you have an Amazon gift card and you spend that Amazon gift card on Amazon, you put in the number, they'll check and make sure that you can actually spend that gift card on Amazon. And if you want to create your own currency, you need some way to verify that the person who's trying to spend that currency actually has that amount of money to spend. And that's essentially what the Bitcoin blockchain is doing, is it's solving what's known as the double spending problem by making that ledger, that history of all your transactions, visible to everyone so everyone can verify that you have the currency to spend.
So what is the problem that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are trying to solve?
Essentially trying to make it so that your online transactions are verifiable. Like you have the original currency. If you want to spend $100 on Amazon, or 100 Bitcoins on Amazon, do you actually have 100 Bitcoins in your wallet that you can claim and then transact in?
A lot of people were attracted to Bitcoin because it was anonymous. It was a blind transaction. You were basically a code changing money with changing currency with somebody else. Mm-hmm. But when you think about what money is just a way of keeping track of who has what. And that was what Bitcoin was doing.
So Bitcoin is anonymous but public. All of your transactions between the two numbers are publicly viewable, right? But you don't necessarily have a number. The number is not necessarily associated with your name. So in that sense, it's anonymous. As long as your name and your account number are not associated, you are actually anonymous. But the moment that changes, it's no longer anonymous. And I could actually go in and see all of the history of your past transactions.
Once you know who's who.
Exactly.
All right. So I'm going to go to the phones here. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We're talking about going cashless, digital wallets, and also what's up with cryptocurrency and blockchain. Casey is on the line. Casey, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm just so happy that you guys brought this subject up. I want to make my comments very short. I have an American Express, and my bank didn't issue Apple Pay for at least 3 years, and that was Frost Bank. And so I just set up with my American Express because I've dealt with fraud multiple times. I've had other credit cards and debit cards that got compromised, and I've exclusively only paid for Apple Pay online and in retail stores, and I've had zero fraudulent behavior, and it's been just great success, and it's protected me through and through.
Casey, thank you for calling. You bring up a great point. Ainsley Harris at Fast Company. Casey says he used credit cards and then he ran into security problems. None of those problems with Apple Pay. So is that going to be the thing that brings people over to the new technology?
It could be, yeah. I think, you know, people rightly, after all the events of the past year, are pretty concerned about their data, whether it's financial data or other forms of data, and how it's being used and potentially stolen online. And, you know, when you think about, you know, a company like PayPal, for example, you know, a huge amount of their resources goes toward identifying potentially fraudulent transactions and dealing with those cases. And, you know, as they get more and more data and process more and more transactions, they're getting smarter and smarter and smarter. And, you know, I think a lot of these newer payments companies, are well positioned to, use data in a way that perhaps traditional financial companies are not as specialized in. And so I think it's going to be really interesting to see that play out. I haven't seen data specifically showing that, across the board, Apple Pay is safer in that sense. But I do think there's enormous potential there, just given the sort of data power that a lot of these sort of newer payments companies have.
So, Tom Moreno at the Bank of San Antonio, how secure are things like Apple Pay, Android Pay? I mean, you see people waving their phones in front of a receiver. You wonder, could someone steal my information just by getting close to me and picking up that data? I don't know. I mean, I don't know how these things work.
So they work on near-field communication, and so you have to have a phone that has that ability. You turn it on, and at the same time, it's not always on. Someone can't just walk past you and scan your phone and read it. You initiate your phone at the time that you want to initiate the transaction, similar to you pull out your card at the time you want to do that. There's certainly some benefits there, but I have very recently heard of some phones being compromised and Apple Pay being compromised as a result of that, and I had not heard that before. I'm a member of several fraud groups here in San Antonio, and one of them is comprised of basically every law enforcement agency you can think of, both local, state, and federal, as well as the different financial institutions. And it was a local financial institution that shared that story with me. So there's certainly some risk, although it is reduced. A number of financial institutions have rolled out some new security for cardholders. So real-time text messages, real-time transaction authentication, and then the ability to turn your card on and off. We offer a solution called Secure Swipe, where our clients can enable that, and it essentially turns their card off 100% of the time. And they enable it when they're getting ready to use it, which if a card is ever used and they have not enabled it, the transaction will be declined. So while the mobile wallets certainly offer some security, there's some constant evolving technology on the card side as well.
And so you talk about, well, someone hacked an iPhone and now they got Apple Pay. That's a problem when we have new technologies, that people expect perfection from new technologies. If you can come up with a technology that is half as likely to be hacked as we have with credit cards or other things, then that would be an improvement, right?
Absolutely. And I think what the caller a moment ago was referencing was more the inconvenience, because cardholders are protected. Most of the cards, and I'm not 100% familiar with Amex, but certainly Visa, MasterCard offer cardholders zero liability, where if you have a fraudulent transaction, you report it and you're made whole. I think the caller was referencing the inconvenience. They have to get a new card, they cancel your card, and you can't use it. So that's certainly a consideration for retail clients that are trying to go out and initiate transactions.
Ainsley Harris at Fast Company. If I'm just using my credit card all the time and rarely have a hard currency on me, dollars, am I cashless?
Are you cashless? Yeah, I would say that you're cashless if you're using a credit card, even if it's not a digital wallet version.
Okay, and so got a question from Joan, email. Do mobile payments increase the cost of purchases, or are there savings that are passed along? Glitches, could that make purchasing impossible, whereas cash is always cash? And do we want to give Apple Pay or whatever access to all of our spending habits? Do we trust someone in all those ways? Those are a lot of questions there. So let me go over and ask you that question, Ainsley Harris, about, first of all, the privacy issue. That's the one people raise the most often. What are the privacy concerns?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, there are many parts of the payment stack, right, in that technology. So, Apple Pay might be what you think of as the wallet that you're using, but then, you have a specific card loaded into it, and then there are, of course, different folks who are doing different pieces of all that processing sort of along the chain between you and the purchase that you're making. So, I guess there are many pieces sort of to the privacy and security here, I want to make sure that, people understand that, it's not just Apple that you're sort of dealing with when you're using a piece of one of these new mobile wallets or digital payments of some kind. I think the there is sort of a critical point here around, you know, whether it's Apple versus some of the other sort of tech players that have started to dabble in payments and some of these things. There's a sort of a critical difference between Apple and someone like a Google or a Facebook. You know, with Apple, they are a hardware company. Yes, they do have some services, but you're buying the hardware, and they sort of have a different kind of structure around how their business works, where their sense of you know, keeping your privacy intact is a little bit different than someone like a Google or a Facebook, that is, where you are in a sense the product, and they're making money off of your data and how they're what they're able to know about you. So I do think there's sort of this hasn't really fully played out yet, but certainly as you think about the different tech players that are starting to kind of get their feet wet potentially in payments, in digital wallets, you know, I think you need to look at sort of what different people's incentives are and how their businesses are structured, and they aren't all equivalent.
So Gina Peters, who's making money off this?
Off of the Bitcoin?
The Bitcoin or the digital wallets or all these things. I mean, how are people, you know, what's the motivation if you're trying to get one of these going? You're going to get a piece out of every transaction? Are you going to steal my data and use and sell that? What's happening here?
So with the miners in Bitcoin are actually the miners are a bad word. They're actually the accountants. They're the ones that are going through and then verifying all the transactions, and then they are paid 12.5 bitcoins if they're the first one to verify all the transactions. So that's how they are making money. That's why mining is such a big thing. You're the accountant of the system verifying all the data.
Right. And so if you get 12.5 bitcoins, that's some sort of reward for that. But the person who came up with Bitcoin in the very beginning, that person's, we don't know who that is.
Or if it's a group of people, Satoshi
right.
Nakamoto.
Yeah, they made money by being early adopters? Or is this an elaborate pump and dump scheme where they pump up the value and then they sell it all off and they allow it to crash, but they made their money?
So the funny thing is with the original Bitcoin is that the Genesis Bitcoin actually is locked away in the wallet. It's not accessible through the general blockchain transactions. So they can't do that. Just that's one of the quirks of the Bitcoin blockchain. That is a concern with a lot of the new coins, the ICOs, where the owners are keeping a lot of the original issuance.
Right.
So they could be doing a pump and dump, and that's a big concern.
So pump and dump, people need to know those two words, you know, because there's a lot of these cryptocurrencies that are being created and are being promoted. I got an email today talking about, hey, here's this new cloud coin and whatever. I don't know anything about it. If I go out and say, well, I saw what Bitcoin did, maybe I need to get in on the ground floor on this. You know, just because Bitcoin was able to soar in value doesn't mean everything else is going to do that.
And no, it's not. Again, I would liken it very much to the internet bubble of the early 2000s. There's some new technologies at play here with blockchain. But that doesn't mean that all the new technologies are going to be good, and it doesn't mean that all of the new coins are actually worth it. Right? Are they creating, are they developing a new technology when they're issuing this coin, or are they just trying to be Bitcoin 2.0?
Right, and what's driving the value of Bitcoin going up, and we've seen it go down some recently, but in 2017 mm-hmm. it shot up like a bottle rocket, mm-hmm. was speculation, I think.
Partially. It's also one of the only cryptos, as far as I know, that can be converted into every other crypto. So it's a very important bridge or intermediate currency.
Okay, but you think that drove the increase in value?
That's definitely part of it, right? Because if I want to go into an ICO, if I want to buy one of these new coins, I typically can buy that coin by giving them Bitcoin. So I need to first buy Bitcoin, which increases the price, and then I give it to this ICO who might sit and hold.
But now we're seeing other things like Litecoin, and they're doing the same thing. That's also a very popular one, but who knows? Every day there's a new one rolling out, and people need to be very cautious. If you don't understand something, don't mm-hmm. invest in it, because that's mm-hmm. how we get these bubbles. We're going to take a quick break. Our phone lines are open. We want to hear your questions and your comments about digital money. This is coming. You know, what do you need to know about it as a consumer, as a businessman, as someone involved in banking, in any transactions? What do you want to know about it? The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The source continues after this break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. How do you choose to pay for things? It used to be you brought cash, or maybe you had a credit card, or you wrote the check. You held everyone up in line at the grocery store by writing that check. Well, if you use online banking, Venmo, Apple Pay, other forms of money management, mobile systems, well, what are the advantages and disadvantages of ways to manage your money? Give us a call. I've got questions or comments about what is this new trend of digital wallets, and what about Bitcoin and other forms of cryptocurrency, blockchain technology as well. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Noble is on the line. And Noble, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
Going great. Go ahead.
I just wanted to call and mention I used to deliver pizza in a small town. Pretty much only used cash, hardly ever had a card reader or anything like that, let alone something like Apple Pay. Most people where I'm from, there's a lot of people, I guess, that can't afford an ISP or can't get a phone with a data plan. So if our state or if our country went cashless, there'd be a lot of people, rural and poor people, that'd be completely left out. I wouldn't be able to make tips. Lots of people that mow lawns and do landscaping and other kind of odd jobs in the gig economy would just be locked out.
All right, Noble, that's a great point. There is some current concern. We have a large segment of the population which is unbanked. They don't use banks to manage their money. And whether if we switch to digital wallets and these types of things, will they be out in the cold? Let me get different answers from each of y'all on this, because Ainsley Harris from Fast Company, what do you think?
Well, it's interesting. I totally that point, I think, is a really important one, that the way things are going, it's very easy to see a world in which certain groups are left behind. However, for me, actually, 2017 was sort of the year that we saw a lot of progress in whether startups or established companies starting to think about ways that digital technologies can actually help these different underbanked or unbanked groups. And, you know, for example, we have someone like Square introducing its Cash App, a sort of prepaid card, very much targeted at that population. We saw IPOs from payday lenders like Curo, and also a company called Elevate. We saw a company called Even teaming up with Walmart to help people get their paychecks, even faster than normal, so you can actually get paid each day rather than waiting 2 weeks. So, you know, certainly there are going to be some trade-offs, I think, as these technologies become more popular. But at the same time, there's also been, I think, a lot of examples of ways in which people are finally kind of waking up to this enormous market, and it is quite large of folks who might have sort of different use cases for what their financial needs are.
We've also seen countries around the world, very impoverished countries in Africa, for example, using digital money when they had hyperinflation happening and people were trading cell phone minutes and things back and forth in the bazaar. So it seems like this is something that's highly adaptable. I don't think that's going to happen in the United States, but you never know where this is going to lead us. But I'm interested to see what Gina Peters, professor of economics at Trinity University, has to tell us about that.
So I think the unbanked question, actually Sweden is grappling with that right now, because they've seen a big decrease in the amount of cash in their economy. And so a lot of retirees are not feeling exactly left out of the economy, but it's harder given how many stores now refuse to accept cash and how many banks and ATMs actually have shut down. So so this is a question, the unbanked question, is actually being addressed by different economies around the world. So I don't think necessarily the U.S. has to come up with new solutions, but we do need to look through what other countries are doing. And it's actually tied into a different but equally serious question of what happens with all these digital solutions if there's, for example, a natural disaster that wipes out the electricity grids, right? If you don't have cash and the electricity goes down, how do you pay?
Yeah, we saw that during this most recent Harvey disaster.
Exactly.
When I went to the Gulf Coast right after the hurricane hit, you said you had to bring cash because all the ATMs were knocked out. Tom Moreno, how are banks looking at this? You're at the Bank of San Antonio. Do you see this as an opportunity to provide services online, on phones, to people who are now unbanked?
Absolutely. And the the payments revolution is happening right now. And so whether we're looking at alternate payments, whether we're looking at checks, whether we're looking at cash, it is happening. And so financial institutions have to figure that out. The unbanked question has been an issue for quite some time as to how do you handle transactions for those individuals. Amazon recently rolled out something called Amazon Cash for this particular issue. And what they're doing is they've partnered with certain merchants where individuals can go and deposit money into their Amazon account, cash, by going to a 7-Eleven or a CVS or a GameStop, and there are others as well. And so what that's doing to financial institutions is it's putting pressure on them to get creative, to come up with new solutions, because there are threats to the financial institution industry, to the balances that banks bring in deposits that they in turn loan out.
We also know that if you're in the cash society and if you're locked in there as unbanked, you lose a lot of your spending power at payday lenders, also at cash checking, check cashing stores, other places like that. If we can come up with ways of dealing, of providing people with the money that they earned efficiently, effectively, securely online, then they could have more of their own money and not pay for services. Let's go to another caller. This is Claiborne. Hi, Claiborne. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Personally, I'm amazed that HEB and Walmart and other places down here don't have Apple Pay activated on their POS systems, which are fully capable of it. And I personally, I'll go 2 blocks out of my way to go somewhere where I can use Apple Pay, because that's a 3-second transaction as opposed to 20 seconds to a minute and a half or more, and having to carry my wallet and manipulate my wallet while juggling a 7-year-old.
Claiborne, thank you so much. We hear you juggling that 5-year-old right now. And so that's going to be a business decision, an act of competitiveness. So let me go to Tom Moreno over at the Bank of San Antonio. When we get to the point where this crystallization, like we're going this way, this is going to happen, suddenly it's going to happen really quick and every business is going to jump on the train?
There's a number of factors that contribute to the decision of the business to do that. And in the examples that the last caller gave, these big box retailers are looking for efficiencies. They want to minimize the number of effort that it takes to process the transaction, and they want to make it as fast as possible, because the more people, the faster they process the transaction, the more people they can help, the more sales they can make. When they're looking at these alternate payment solutions through their point of sale solution they have at the cash register, it is typically interfacing with their back-end accounting system. And so if they have not been able to integrate that yet, that might be a reason why they have that particular feature turned off. There is also rules, regulations associated with those payments, and what liability the business has versus what recourse the consumer has. So all of those come into play.
But when I buy something at the store with a credit card, the retailer is having to pay a fee, right?
Absolutely.
I don't see it as the consumer, but there's a back-end fee going on. And we know that if you're a retailer, that the margins are really tight. And so you're eating into that. So if we were able to come up with QR codes like they have up in China and other places around the world to start paying for things, wouldn't that be save money overall and help build wealth in the overall economy?
It depends on who's clearing that transaction. The whole idea of the fees that are involved to process transactions have to do with the infrastructure that's put into place. When you dip your card or swipe your card, that is going through an entire channel of processing options to authenticate that card, to verify the funds are available, and then to give an authorization code that says, yes, this transaction is approved. All of that infrastructure costs money. Therefore, those transaction costs are passed to the retailer to make sure that that transaction is good.
So you're paying for the security.
Absolutely.
All right, another caller. Let me go to Michael. And Michael, you're on The Source. Go ahead.
Yes. I use a technology called Samsung Pay, which is different from Apple or Android Pay in the fact that it uses the technology called magnetic secure transfer, which basically mimics your credit card at any credit card terminal. So the caller that was complaining about, you can't use that at Walmart, that kind of stuff. Well, I can actually use Samsung Pay at the Walmart terminal using your Samsung phone, or in my case, my Samsung watch that has Samsung Pay. And this is very also useful for gas stations that do not support any type of digital digital form of payment. I can use my watch at a gas station, and so I can use that knowing that I don't have any risk of any credit card skimming that might occur. Since all these digital forms of payments use a one-time tokenization process that prevents my actual credit card information from being, you know, stolen or taken. So yeah, I use Samsung Pay, and it's been great for me.
All right, Michael, thank you for that. So skimming, we know that sometimes there are people who are attached devices to gasoline pumps, and when you put in your credit card and slide it out, and they may be watching to see how you pump in your code, and they're able to steal your debit information, and you're, you know, now you're going to lose your, they're going to rob you. And so Ainsley Harris at Fast Company, is Michael, is he, you know, part of the cutting edge?
Yeah, I think he is. I think it's great that he's found something that works for him in all those scenarios. I think it really underscores the fact that, you know, as much as we're talking about all these options, consumers don't really want a million options, right? They want just to be able to have the simplest solution possible and be able to use it consistently. And, you know, for a long time, you know, the problem of sort of clutter in the wallet was one of, you know, maybe you had a dozen different credit cards from different retailers that you had signed up for various reasons and that kind of thing. And now we have sort of a little bit of this different kind of clutter. Maybe it's app clutter or digital wallet clutter plus the traditional wallet all at once. And, you know, I think people don't necessarily want more payment solutions in the way that the industry always wants to offer them. Instead, they maybe want something like, you know, there's a startup called Affirm that's offering sort of point-of-sale financing solutions. And so instead right. of, you know, signing up for a retailer credit card, you
okay.
are...
All right, Ainsley, we'll talk more about that when we come back from this break. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. The source continues after this. Are you current with currency? We're talking about that today on The Source. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. Apple Pay, Bitcoin, blockchain, all of these things. It's coming fast, and we don't know which is going to be the winner. How is this going to impact all of us in society, from consumers to businesses to bankers and from people who are unbanked? 210-614-8980. Gio is on the line. Gio, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. First time, long time. So I got a question and a comment. See if one of your guests can comment on the process of buying crypto and using the exchanges and which one they feel is the best. And then also how cryptocurrency is called currency, but no one I actually know that has it uses it to buy things. The only time I've ever used Bitcoin to actually buy something is to deposit on my sports book or buy other cryptos like Ripple or Stellar. Thanks.
All right, Gio, thanks for calling in. Appreciate your expertise. You seem like you're a user. So let's go to, you know, Gina Peters, professor of economics at Trinity University, and she is with the blockchain technologies at the University College London Center. So that's, you know this stuff.
Yes, I do. So I'm going to actually answer the last question first, which is why everyone calls it a currency. There are many hills to die on, and I am not going to die on the fact that it's money or not money. I just always call it a medium of exchange, because there is a question of, is it actually a currency or is it actually money? It is definitely a medium of exchange, because you are using it to buy other stuff.
Is it pegged to the dollar?
No, okay. It is not. There is one that is. It's called the U.S. dollar tether. It is an interesting one that I don't buy for reasons.
But you can't. But it's very rare that I could do anything with Bitcoin to go purchase something other than maybe I want to fly in space on, you know, the Virgin spacecraft. Oh, you can buy stock with it?
No, you can buy on Overstock, actually. Overstock accepts Bitcoin, as does Expedia, if you want to go and book a trip. Newegg Dish Network, they actually accept it as well. Microsoft does. There's a lot of gift cards you can buy using Bitcoin as well.
So the problem is, we'll get into all the questions that the caller raised, but the blockchain verification, that can take how long?
The Bitcoin one, and remember, this is where all the blockchains are different. So Bitcoin is designed to take 10 minutes, but some of them, Dash or Litecoin, these can take seconds.
Okay, so it's gotten a lot faster.
Bitcoin is currently hard-coded to take 10 minutes. Like, how long that transaction takes to be verified is part of the security system of the blockchain. And that's where I don't want to get into too much details about how they're all different, but that it is as fast as it is programmed to be.
Okay.
Except blockchain, The Bitcoin blockchain has been having some issues recently. Last time I tried to transfer some Bitcoins, it took 3 hours. I was transferring to somebody in Europe, and it normally takes at most 10 minutes. 3 hours was a long time to wait for them to get the Bitcoin.
Sure, you could go up and go down in that time.
Exactly.
So to Gio's call also, people use it, cryptocurrencies in the black market. People do sports betting online. Mm-hmm. And buy other tokens online for things. We know that Silk Road, which was used to buy narcotics online, was also a big first adopter of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so actually, funnily enough, now that Bitcoin is more public, there's a lot of cryptocurrencies coming up that are trying to hide the blockchain record so that you don't have the ability to see all the transactions.
Right, like Monero.
Exactly. That's the one I was thinking of. They are trying to make it easier to hide your transactions. And there's a question sort of in the reverse, because some central banks are talking about creating their own cryptocurrencies to facilitate transactions. Russia is talking about the crypto ruble, which would allow them to literally track all of the transactions between all the people if they were to use the normal blockchain technology, which would be a high degree of surveillance. And how comfortable are people with that if central banks begin issuing cryptocurrencies using this blockchain technology?
So, Gina, how much do consumers need to know about this? I mean, I can go to the store and I can conduct my business, I can get paid at my job and never, ever have to come in contact with cryptocurrency?
I think that's going to be true for a while, but I think there are some new interesting business models coming up on the blockchains, on the ICOs. For example, there's one called Steam, which is essentially, it's like a Facebook or Twitter, but every time you get a like, you're actually getting Steam coins. So they're trying to monetize social media engagement.
I've heard about the like economy before, but I don't know we're actually going to be using that to buy things with.
So Steam is a coin. But I think to the extent that you'll see general purchasing happening in cryptos, you'll need to get a more stable, it's called a stable coin. You need one that has a more stable price. There's a lot of people now are calling Bitcoin a crypto asset because so many people are buying it for investment purposes instead of as a currency.
Ainsley Harris at Fast Company. Do consumers need to start paying attention to Bitcoin?
I think part of the reason they have started paying attention is because if you look at sort of the broader context here, Bitcoin is, all these cryptocurrencies are in a way, it's this whole alternate system, right? And it exists outside of all these sort of middlemen, whether it's government or financial institutions. And so if you want to have a hedge against the system, blockchain, Bitcoin is the way to do it. I think when you hear even, investors who have quite a bit of Bitcoin, I think they would say, 99% you should probably have in sort of your regular investment assets, and then maybe this is the 1%. I've heard folks kind of float that as a way to think about it. Maybe not the thing to sell all your life savings and throw them all into Coinbase or something like that, but I think thinking about it as a way to sort of, as people are growing increasingly disillusioned, perhaps, with some of our existing institutions, if you do want to hedge that, this is the best mechanism that we have right now.
It's no coincidence that Bitcoin was minted initially right after, like, the fall of Bear Stearns and the global meltdown of the economy. Jesus is on the line. Jesus, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to see if your panel could address the concept of volatility. Bitcoin is usually referred to as a volatile coin, but the dollar is not, and the dollar lost 10% in the last year, while Bitcoin went up 1,349%. So it's just a discussion about volatility.
Okay, so let's go back to our expert on Bitcoin, and that would be Gina Peters.
So I think this ties into the earlier question or the earlier answer I was giving in regards to the importance of having a stable coin if you want to actually integrate it more with the economy. A lot of people are buying Bitcoin in part because of these huge price fluctuations. A 10% price fluctuation really is nothing, which is, I think, why Ainsley's advice about not, betting the house on Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrency is very wise.
But the dollar is backed by United States government, then U.S. Treasury bonds. It has the full faith and credit of the U.S. economy behind it. You know, what's propping up Bitcoin is basically what people think it's worth.
It's the value of the transaction network that Bitcoin allows, right? I mean, Bitcoin.
There is no Federal Reserve for Bitcoin.
No. But remember, the U.S. dollar doesn't have anything physical backing it either. A lot of people, for some reason, still think it's backed by gold, and that's not true. Right?
But what is gold? You know,
exactly. Right.
So it's a nice, pretty metal, but does it actually have? You know, it only has the value which we assign to it.
It is used in some electronics, to be fair.
I mean, yeah, sure, but you know, the other things are as well.
Yes.
So okay, and Ainsley Harris, you know, the dollar. People are saying one thing about the dollar: it has vulnerabilities itself. If I have a fistful of dollars, a pocketful of dollars, if I lose my wallet and all my money is stolen, that money is gone. Whoever holds that dollar has control over that money. Is there some sort of protection that we have more for digital dollars that we don't have for our old-fashioned regular dollars?
If anything, I think, the digital world right now is just a question of so much uncertainty, right? At least you know if you lose that cash in your actual wallet, or if you have a suitcase full of cash or whatever it is, if it's gone, it's gone, and you know that. I think sometimes now it's just even murkier in the digital world. Maybe you lost your special code that you need for your wallet, and maybe you'll find it, maybe you won't. I think there's just, all of this stuff is so new. I think we're all just sort of learning as we go, and that kind of carries a different kind of risk.
And Tom Moreno, Executive Vice President of Technology and Operations at the Bank of San Antonio, what are people coming to you? What do they want to know, particularly, other bank officials, and saying, where do we have to be? How do we position ourselves? Let's not get on the bleeding edge, but let's anticipate where we need to be and be prepared to go there.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the payments revolution is happening today, and I am proud to say that the Federal Reserve convened a payments task force in 2015, and they have had a number of discussions and ideas, but one of their goals is by 2020 to allow anyone with a U.S. bank account to have near real-time payments in a secure fashion. The challenge with that is that, as I mentioned earlier, the payments revolution is happening now. So whether we're talking about Zelle, whether we're talking about Venmo, PayPal, even Facebook is allowing payments, iMessenger is allowing payments. It's happening now where you can send real-time payments. And what the government is trying to get a hold of is how can they make sure that they're secure and trackable? Because people that are doing illegal things usually are doing that with cash, and their goal is to try to get that cash back into the economy. If I can buy drugs from you, if I can buy something, stolen goods from you, and just Venmo it to you, how is that going to be tracked, and how are we going to be able to stop that? So those are all questions that are being asked right now.
Ainsley Harris, how should people get used to this? Should we experiment? Should I go ahead and fire up my Apple Pay and buy lunch with it just to see what it's like?
Yeah, I think it depends on what you're thinking of experimenting with, but certainly Apple Pay, sure, go for it. Maybe download Coinbase and check it out. I think that it's worth always exploring these different things, but also being aware, for example, on Coinbase, within seconds of verifying your email, you'll get another email from them telling you that you have been given, a limit of $10,000 and a credit card limit of $750, and you should go ahead and start trading. I think there is certainly some incentives to keep in mind.
So go slow. Go slow.
Yes, exactly.
Ainsley Harris, Fast Company, thank you for joining us. Also, we're joined by Tom Moreno, Jr., Executive Vice President of Technology and Operations at the Bank of San Antonio. Gina Peters with us, Professor of Economics at Trinity University, Research Associate at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, a fellow at the University College London Center for Blockchain Technologies. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.